Hello and welcome to Behind the Book, the monthly guest episode of the Creating Happy Writers podcast. Here is where I sit down with brilliant female authors and industry experts who are shaking up the publishing world. In each episode, we explore the powerful ideas and expertise within their books and then uncover the personal story of how they brought that knowledge to the page. Whether you're drafting your business book right now, polishing your manuscript, or dreaming of seeing your expertise in print, these conversations will fuel your creative fire and give you the tools to write with confidence. So join me today for the kind of honest talk about the writing life you won't find anywhere else. Hello and welcome to episode 104. Today I'm chatting to the brilliant Dr. Laura Williams. Laura is a clinical psychologist, private therapist, trauma specialist, online course creator and media contributor. She is also a widow and mum who had to put all her psychological expertise into practice when faced with the sudden death of her much loved husband. Her book, What to Do When You Feel Broken, was published by Hay House in February 2025. In this brilliant book, Laura uses her own personal story to illustrate key psychological concepts we can all benefit from applying to our lives, including getting to know yourself fully and understand what drives your behaviour and how it impacts your relationships. Examining your early conditioning to gain new insights into destructive feelings that you may have repressed for years, and how to use Laura's four-step heal framework to move forward consciously on a new path. The toolbox of knowledge and techniques in this book will empower you to pick up your broken parts and put them back together to live life with resilience, wisdom, and fortitude. During our conversation, we discuss writing as healing, how Laura used writing to process grief, and why journaling can be so therapeutic, trauma and feeling broken, exploring the idea that many of us secretly feel defective and how to move beyond that, generational patterns, understanding how trauma and beliefs can be passed down through families, perfectionism and self-compassion, learning to notice unhelpful patterns and offer ourselves more kindness, the reality of publishing, what it was like to get a Hay House deal, navigate imposter syndrome and build momentum as a debut author. This is a conversation packed with tools to help you with your own mental health journey and inspiration for your writing one. I hope you enjoy listening. Welcome, Laura. Thank you so much for joining me today. I am so excited to talk to you because I feel like I've been following your book journey for a while now. So I'm thrilled that you're here. I just wondered whether you would mind starting off with kind of sharing a little bit about what led you to write the book you've written.
Yes, well, thank you for having me, first of all. It feels like we've known each other for quite a while now in the digital space, but yeah, so my book writing journey was essentially that I lost my husband very suddenly in 2018. I'm a clinical psychologist and it felt like a moment where if there was anything that I had to say to the world that was meaningful, this was what it would be about. And I obviously was in, you know, a really difficult place for a good couple of years and just trying to look after myself and my children. But I knew very early on that I wanted to write about it. Fast forward a few years later, I attended a Hay House Writers workshop with a view to writing my manuscript or at least starting it. And you and I had found each other maybe just before that. And I was, you know, I'd spoken to you once or twice about potentially doing some work, but I just never had started that. And so I attended the workshop. I procrastinated for a good 4 or 5 months after that. And then with about a month to go, I finally wrote down, you know, about 11,000 words, I think it was, for the book proposal, put it in, and was absolutely shocked to find that I'd won the competition. So that's how I got my publishing contract with Hay House. It was such an amazing sort of experience to win that. But then there was that real sort of horror of, oh my God, I now have to write an entire book. And as someone who'd never done that before, I'd obviously written professionally, but this was something completely different. So it has been a journey and I am out the other side of that now with the book published. And so there's a whole new set of things that are happening off the back of that. But yeah, I'm so delighted to finally be an author. It's something that I'd always wanted to do, even from when I was a little girl. So yeah, so this is where you find me.
It's a lovely journey to hear about, even though it started off with something that was obviously a terrible tragedy. I wonder, do you feel that writing the book has helped you therapeutically? Because sometimes people say writing is therapeutic and we can use it to help us process our emotions and to come to terms with things. Do you feel like that was part of your journey?
Yes, absolutely. And I started writing very early on after my husband's loss. Writing is a tool that I use with my patients and clients as a clinical psychologist often. And so initially I started writing down the events of what happened because my brain was so foggy, my head was so foggy. I wanted to have like an aid memoir to help me remember what had led up to everything. And, you know, and that was as much to do with me as it was to do with my children and having something that I could use to help them understand because they were so little at the time. But I find that writing process incredibly cathartic, and it reminded me that I could write and that what I was writing wasn't actually just an aid memoir, it was story and it was narrative. And, you know, eventually that's what, you know, became my book. So yeah, it definitely helped me therapeutically, and it's a tool that I use often.
Would you mind just sharing with the listeners, what do you think, you know, from your expertise as a clinical psychologist, what is it that helps with when it comes to writing? What do you think it is that it does for us emotionally, for our brain health? Can you just share a bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I don't know what the research would say on this, but what I found for myself and for my clients is that it takes us from a place often of avoidance into a place of facing something that can be, you know, traumatic to face. I think that is the power in writing. And oftentimes when we're writing, particularly if we're allowing ourselves to be very free with that, it allows us to say things that perhaps we didn't know we needed to say. It becomes a process of, in psychology, we call it free association, where you're just writing unabated, you're not editing, you're not thinking, you're not worrying about who will read it or what they will think. So it becomes this very natural place of really pouring your soul out onto a page. And I think that's why therapeutically it can have such a powerful impact on people.
Yeah, I think I've been trying this year to really make time for journaling.
Yeah.
Because I've done it in the past on and off. I've never been consistent with it, mainly because it's one of those things that unless you in your head tell yourself that it's a priority, it can be easily something that comes off the list of things to do. But I definitely have started this year very, very purposefully and intentionally making it something I do before I do anything else in terms of work or anything that even my own writing when it comes to books. It's the journaling stuff just I found this year has just really helped process so many things that I've been thinking about that perhaps, like you say, I haven't found a way of being able to talk to other people about, mm-hmm. but just putting it on the page and reflecting on it and allowing that freedom, I suppose, of expression. And like you said, that there's nobody there, especially for me as a writer, I'm sure you'll get this as well, that there's nobody going to read it. It's not for anybody else. Yes. Other than us. And I think when you're used to writing for other people all the time, when you come to do this, it's sort of that letting go of that expectation that other people are going to read it, and actually nobody is. So there's that freedom there, isn't there?
Yes, absolutely. And as you're speaking, I mean, I only maybe a year ago or so, I found The Artist's Way. So if anyone hasn't read that, that really talks to that powerful expression of yourself through creativity and journaling every day as a practice. And I'm sure we'll come on to that in terms of writing practice. But I think it's the freedom, as you say, of not expecting that someone else will read it, because I think the book had to become something a bit different and attenuated because there's parts of my trauma and parts of our story that are mine to hold and my children's to hear and not for the world. But equally, I have been quite vulnerable and shared a lot within it, I think.
What do you think led you to talk about this idea of feeling broken, particularly the word broken? I think that's a really interesting choice of word to use. Do you find it's something that is typical of what you perhaps see in your practice, or that you've just noticed in your expertise as a psychologist, but also just your experience of going through something traumatic?
Yeah, so it is an idea that comes from clinical practice, actually, and from a particular therapy called schema-based therapy. So if anybody wants to read up on that, schema therapy is where that comes from. And it's this idea that many people I see in clinical practice will have that schema or relational pattern where they feel defective or broken in some way. The title of the book came out of a workshop that I delivered. I talk about that in the book, where I titled the event, "You Are Not Broken." And actually, it was so well attended because I think it spoke to that really sort of inherent truth that all of us feel a little bit broken inside somewhere, and that we're actually not as well functioning as people might believe us to be. Because my original title was not that. I was going back and forward with my publisher, and I put all the titles of all the things I've done, and they honed in on that one and said, that's it. And I was happy to go with that, because I think many people have emailed me and talked about the book title in particular and how it's drawn them, because it's a secret that they hold that they wouldn't share necessarily. So I think that was important.
It's a great way of looking at how to, and I know this comes off topic a little bit about the theme of the book, but just in terms of choosing titles, I think it's trying to find a balance of something that feels right, but also something that is going to attract attention, because, yes, you know, that whole nobody judges a book by its cover thing is obviously not real, because we all do that. But I think isn't it, as an author, trying to find that balance between something that feels true to what the book is about and true to who you are as an author, but also as a professional, and then what's going to market well, what's going to, you know, leap off the shelves for people when they are looking at books. Because I don't know whether you feel like this, but I know that there's so much out there within this sort of space of, you know, healing ourselves and understanding ourselves, that I think choosing a title like that, you know, is a great move, because like you said, it's that hidden part that maybe we don't want to admit that we feel broken. So when we see it, you feel that you can almost self-identify with the title before you've even picked the book up to look what's inside it. So yeah, hats off to you for such a great title. But I do think it's such an interesting thing, isn't it, that we are now, I suppose, inundated a little bit with options when it comes to trying to manage our emotions. And we hear so many different people saying so many different things that I feel like it's a place where there can be lots of different options for people to think about when it comes to trying to manage their emotional well-being and their mental health. Do you think people are looking for like a quick fix, or do you think people are now actually realizing that it's a lot of work, it's a lot of inner work that has to be done?
I think this answer comes in two parts. I think there are people out there who are looking for a quick fix when they come to self-development, and I think that has to be debunked quickly. And actually, it is one of the things that I'm really keen to talk about, and I say it in the book. If you're looking for a quick fix around this stuff, it's not there. This is a practice of every day understanding your psychology, understanding what drives you, the good and the bad, and really taking that level of self-awareness towards whatever you face so that you can become more resilient with that knowledge in your toolbox. Some of the reviews I've had have talked to that idea of this is not, you know, she says it's not a quick fix, because I don't want for people to view this as cookie self-development work. This is deep, fundamental, lifelong work. And, you know, as much as like the title is What to Do When You Feel Broken, and it talks to that human truth, underneath all of that, the themes of the book are things that I see clinically daily and often. And, you know, I think the challenge of a book like this is to convey psychological knowledge, models, terminology in a way that's relatable to someone so that they can pick it up and get something from it and move forward with it.
I absolutely agree. And I say this very often, particularly when people perhaps are coming with a clinical background, with an experience where, you know, you perhaps are very academic in terms of what they've had to write before, and being able to help people understand some of the things that, I mean, because obviously emotional health psychology is so technical, when if you're learning about it, and, you know, you'll have had to have done this to do the job that you do, but it's being able to make that understandable for the everyday person. And I will often work with people who just are so used to writing in an academic, really technical way, and I'm having to stop and look up something on Google because I don't know what it means as a reader. I mean, you know, and as an editor, and I will look and think, I don't even understand what that sentence means. So I will go, and I will say to people, as soon as that happens, as soon as people are having to put the book down to go and look up what that word means, we've lost them, because it's hard work then, isn't it? It becomes something yes. that feels like work. So I think it's great that, you know, your whole idea behind making it manageable and relatable, but also understandable just for the everyday person sounds yes. like such, yeah, a great move, because that can be the thing that puts people off, I suppose, learning about this, is that, is it going to be very scientific, and am I going to have to really up my science knowledge? And, you know, for a lot of people, that's just not the way they want to consume books. So yeah, brilliant. Now, I did write down some notes because I just found so much of what you were talking about so fascinating in the book. And I'd love to talk a little bit about trauma, not so much what trauma is, because I think people probably have a definition of it, but it's just this idea about the misconceptions, I suppose. What do you think people's misconceptions are of trying to heal after a traumatic event? Because I think we all go through, and I know Edith Eger always says, you know, there's no hierarchy on trauma. And that it's so interesting, because when I think about it, you can imagine trauma being something like, you know, that you had gone through, something like that, when actually trauma can be, I guess it's relatable to you as a person, isn't it? What you find traumatic is very personal to you. So something that's traumatic for one person wouldn't necessarily seem traumatic, but it is for them personally. So what do you think the misconceptions are of trying to understand trauma, but also heal from it?
Sure. So I think you're picking up on something that's fundamental to my work as a psychologist, and that is that it doesn't matter what my perception of your experience is, it matters what yours is.
Yeah.
And so whatever someone brings to therapy is what you're working with, because that's their trauma. It's their perception of the event, the meaning that is held behind that for them, which will be different from someone else. And so that's the fundamental first part of understanding trauma. And then in terms of like the misconceptions, I think that oftentimes what people think is that trauma is often the big stuff. So I talk in the book about the way that trauma has, you know, been Americanized in a way where they talk about sort of big T and little T. And I use that terminology in the book because I think it's helpful for people to understand it. But I think what that's meant is that people think that trauma is just the big stuff. Mm. So the neglect, the abuse, you know, those types of things that we see in society that make the newspapers. Mm-hmm. And actually, I fundamentally believe that all of us will be holding some experiences in our life which are and have been traumatic because of how they make us feel. I'm very much talking to those people out there who are functioning, who are holding down jobs, who are doing well in their lives, but actually there's been relational experiences with their caregivers that perhaps haven't been ideal, and fundamentally that these experiences existed in loving families too. Mm. And I think that's hugely, hugely important, because what people do is they gaslight themselves into believing, well, what have I got to be depressed about? Mm. What have I got to be anxious about? And the truth of it is that when people come to therapy and you pull back a few layers of the onion, there's all sorts of, you know, challenges and difficulties that they've never been able to speak about or have never even recognised them as a traumatic event for them. And it's a hard one, because I've had people online say to me, you're pathologising normal family relationships. And I would argue I'm actually trying to do exactly the opposite of that. I'm trying to normalise the you and I who are walking about in our lives, but who had experiences with our parents who were loving and supportive, but sometimes maybe held high expectations for us and we felt it, you know? And that's one of the threads that runs through this book, is perfectionism and my need to achieve and be successful. And I'm sat here now with a book that just hit the Amazon Kindle bestseller list in the UK and the US. That's not a coincidence. So I'm still living that psychological drive to succeed and achieve, but I'm aware of it. And I know when those things maybe tip the balance and I have to be really careful about, you know, where that line is. Mm.
Julia Samuel talks about generational trauma, doesn't she? That trauma can actually come down through you know, the genetics, I suppose, isn't it? That when yeah. there could be something that happened in generations above you, that you're actually, your body, your cells are still processing, which I just find absolutely fascinating. Because I think about my grandmother. My dad, and she left Poland when the Nazis invaded in the early 1940s, and she walked from Poland to the south of Italy with him on her back, and they caught a boat to Scotland, and he came over as a refugee in the 1945. And I always think, you know, at the time, it's just a fascinating story, because yes. for me, as her granddaughter, to hear when she was alive, her talk about it, she was very, very, you know, passionate about what had happened, obviously, to her. But I do think it's interesting when you're young and you think that's just a story and that happened, and for my dad as well to experience that. But I then think actually all of that would have been terribly traumatic, of course. But then you wonder how much has come down sort of the chain to myself, to my sisters, to then my children. And yes. I know Julia always talks about, you know, going in, when you have therapy, it's like trying to unpick, you know, the kind of the causes of some of these traumatic things that maybe you don't even realize are causing you that sort of pain. Do you feel that that's something that you see commonly within your practice, but also, you know, when you're in kind of your own knowledge about this stuff?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I've got goosebumps hearing that story and how important these stories are generationally for our families. But I think the generational trauma part of this, there's an entire chapter that I dedicate to talking about my grandmother, my mother, myself, and then on to my daughter and the things that have passed down. And I think these things pass down in two ways, I guess, is the way that I look at it. And one is relationally, when we are modelled to by our parents and our grandparents, how we're supposed to behave and what we're supposed to do and all those types of things. And then there's the area that I know far less about, which is in the epigenetics of it. So this idea that when you've been exposed to that level of toxic stress, trying to flee your home country to safety, what does that do when you're under that level of toxic stress? What does it do to your brain and your body? And then how does that alter gene expression, is the way that I understand that. Now, obviously, I, you know, I'm not an epigeneticist. I don't know lots about that, but there's more and more evidence coming out that those things are sort of following us in ways that we don't always understand. And I see that often. I see the expression of, you know, my own ways of being in the world that I can see reflected in my own mum and my grandmother before me. And I think it's important that we understand those stories, because these things didn't happen by accident. And often they're out with our conscious control for years. And I think part of the reason why I do this work is to help people build that level of self-awareness so that they can then make more informed choices when they see there's that behaviour showing up again. And it's like that record player on repeat and repeat and repeat and repeat. And actually, it's trying to create what people will talk about, that liminal space between there's that pattern again and what am I going to choose when I give myself the time to make that decision.
Yeah, and not blaming ourselves, I suppose, either, because unless we do the work to understand where some of our behaviours come from and why we behave the way we do, yeah. and that actually some of it may be from previous generations that we're processing, you know, even maybe without even knowing, that it's about, I suppose, there's a self-compassion piece, isn't there, around what can we be doing to, like you said, acknowledge and notice, but also think to ourselves, do you know what, this is, everybody will be processing things. There's nobody that will go through the human experience without having to process, you know, stress, trauma, you know, because that's just the way it's, you know, that life is, and that we're sort of designed to. I know there's there should be a level of stress in life to kind of keep us on our toes, but it's that kind of toxic stress, isn't it? Where it's just, you know, over and over, like you said, that repetition of a cycle that we probably don't even know that our brain is doing. And yeah, it's absolutely fascinating. You touched a little bit on perfectionism as something that, you know, and I am 100%, that is me in terms of, and that kind of high expectation of myself, and knowing that it's good in some ways to have those high expectations and to be wanting to strive for things. But then there's other parts of me where I'm like, no, this is actually something that's, is not a great trait for me to have in certain situations, like hanging the washing, because me and my husband disagree on that majorly, because I have a very perfectionist tendency about how to hang washing and he does not. So, but yeah, I think, I mean, joking aside, of course, but perfectionism is one thing. But what are the other things? What are the other behaviors that you see? And, you know, maybe our listeners will be able to kind of maybe recognize in themselves that is their way of dealing with maybe trauma or stress that perhaps they didn't realize was linked?
Yeah, I mean, obviously it's very different for everyone. And just as you're talking about that perfectionism, I think just to sort of give a bit more of the theory behind this stuff. So essentially, when we're in that perfectionistic mode of operating, what we're really doing is we are our own demanding parent in operation. So we've internalized that demanding parent into our own repertoire of how we live our lives. And then we show up and we're berating ourselves. And therapy is about noticing that you have that demanding parent mode in the driving seat and being able to say, no, I'm going to offer myself that compassion. And so what you're really doing is reparenting yourself through all of the patterns that are unhelpful. And as Mel Robbins will say, there's no one else coming to save you now. You're an adult. You need to do it for yourself. And the first step towards that is self-awareness, right? But I mean, I see all sorts of patterns, you know, so perfectionism is just one of them. Often driven by fear of failure, which is the schema that underlies it. Often driven by these feelings of, I'm actually broken inside. So if I can, you know, these are all overcompensation modes. If I can overcompensate and be as perfectionistic as I possibly can, no one will know that underneath I'm actually completely broken and not really functioning as a human the way I should. And I think, again, that touches on this idea of, you know, vulnerability like this and being able to know and be vulnerable about our flaws and the difficulties that we have reduces the shame. And it's the shame that keeps us stuck and it keeps us in these cycles because we believe that nobody else is the way that we are. We think that we're unique in it all. And of course, you know, it's just not true. And I think, again, that's one of the reasons why I chose to use my story in this book, because I want people to really understand I'm a clinical psychologist and I've done this job for 20 plus years and I am not perfect, far from it. And there are days when I am still struggling to function. Mm. And there are days when my perfectionistic over-controller mode is in the driving seat and I have to wind that back and show myself the compassion. So I think it will be different for everyone. And therapy is something that could go on for a long time. You know, understanding yourself could go on forever.
Like it probably does, to be honest. I think it's I think it's about, for me, it's about embracing that and thinking, do you know what? I want to discover more about why perhaps I do things that way or who I am as a person and what do I really want to be like? How do I really want to live my life? And I feel like that, like you said, everything starts with that kind of awareness thing, doesn't it? Awareness is the first step. And as soon as you're aware of it, you can do something about it. And I know Mel says, nobody's coming. And I feel that there's part of me that I absolutely get that. And I absolutely know that. But there's also part of me that thinks, well, I hope people know that actually somebody can help you to process it. It's not that nobody's coming to rescue you. It is a fundamentally down to you to think, right, what do I need in order to be able to heal? It's not that, you know, people aren't going to just come because that they assume you need them or that, you know, they vaguely have picked up that perhaps you want some help. It's about, I suppose, being proactive and thinking, right, I've identified some of these things. I want to unpack why I do this, or I want some ways to help me overcome this and to get these patterns to, you know, I guess the neural pathways and all those things that happen in the brain around behavior. I just think it's so important, isn't it, that people do then reach out and find that help and talk about
these things. Of course. And I think Mel sort of line talks to that bit of like, you need to be where it starts.
Yeah.
And then you need to work out what do you need. And actually schema is a model of unmet needs. So it's based on the premise of, as an infant, a young child, you have had needs left unmet. And what you've attempted to do is find ways to overcompensate for the lack of whatever you've not had. And I think that's hugely important for people to understand. You know, there's a story in the book where I talk about going to my husband's funeral. There's stories abound in my family about how independent I was, marching off to the bottom of the street at four because I decided I was leaving home. And I'm, you know, I'm that person who the narrative is I'm really independent. And I tell the story, I get out of the car at the funeral and my mum was like, do you want your dad? And I was like, no, I just want my mum. And and just knowing that actually sometimes you just need that, need to be looked after by someone else, and you have to, as an adult, ask for that. It's hugely important.
And also recognising, I think, when friends and family might be, through their behaviours, asking for help, but they're not able to verbalise it. And I think children are a great way, and teenagers, you know, I've got two teenagers that I sometimes think actually for some reason, whether it's that they don't want to admit that they want some help with something, but often it's their behaviour where I'm like, oh, hang on a minute, you're a little bit, being a little bit, maybe it's snappy, or, and I think actually, what are they trying to communicate? Because all behaviour is communication, you know, I remember that from teaching, and it's very much, you know, what is the behaviour showing me that maybe requires me to say, are you all right? That, are you okay? Yes. Can I help you with something? Because maybe for some people, admitting that they need help is too much. It's too much to say, could you help me here, or I'm struggling here? And they'll act out so that you end up asking them.
Yes. And actually, you know, it's one of the things that I attempt. I won't always do this, but in therapy, rather than, you know, starting sessions off with agendas and how are you, I will say, what do you need today? What do you need from me today? You know, and I think that's such a hugely important distinction, because we're there because there's a need. And when people pick up a book like mine, it's because of they've read that title and they've recognised something within them that's actually about an unmet need of theirs. So they feel broken. They feel there's a part of themselves that they can't be honest about and share. And they're hoping that they find something in this that will make them feel more normal.
Yeah. And I think you've got the HEAL framework in there, haven't you, that helps people. Could you just share a bit more about what that is?
Yeah. So, I mean, essentially, it's a framework just to help people to think about what they need. So highlighting the difficulty and going through that step by step until you've met that need. And the reason I did that is not to have some sort of fancy framework. It was more to sort of take the framework of psychological therapy of assessment, formulation, which is telling the story, treatment, and then evaluation, and putting it into language that people would understand. And the end of that framework, I won't give it all away, but the end of that framework is letting it lift. Mm. And I think it's hugely important that I say within this, when I'm talking about the book and when I'm talking about therapy for trauma, I am not a therapist who wants people to get stuck in their narrative. I want them to understand their narrative so that they can then move forward. And I think sometimes people can get stuck in the telling of the sad story over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. And I'm really keen that people give themselves the chance to have their story witnessed and heard so that they feel validated. But then it's about pushing forward. And I think sometimes that's the difference between clinical psychology, which is quite directive about what are we doing about this now? What's the treatment and how are we evaluating whether this has worked, versus, you know, maybe supportive counselling can be a bit less directive about those things. And it's not that one's better than the other, but I just very much align to this idea of people need to understand to move forward, not to stay stuck.
Yeah. What are some of the exercises and ideas in the book that, you know, maybe if you're willing to just choose maybe one or two that you think, you know, the listener might think would be a useful activity or exercise to do to help them?
Yeah, so there's a couple that spring to mind. I'll talk about two very briefly. So one is this idea of self-formulation. So telling your own story and understanding that for yourself. And I use another therapeutic tool from within cognitive analytical therapy to help people do a relational formulation, because I believe quite strongly that people will often, if they're looking for support, they'll often be offered initially cognitive behavioural therapy, which can often be sort of 6 to 8 sessions, understanding a bit. But then it's often quite symptom focused. It neglects sometimes the relational aspects. And so I think readers of this book will be getting an inkling into, well, actually, what's the relational difficulties that have led to where I'm at and why I'm anxious? Because for me, the anxiety, the depression is the symptom of the underlying problem. It's not the problem itself. So the self-formulation allows them a chance to work that all through themselves. And then the last sort of exercise in the book is what I've called a holistic needs assessment. And again, I've used the model from actually within prison-based work. So I used to work in jails in Scotland years ago, and we used this sort of framework to help people think about what makes a good life after offending. And I think that actually applies to just being what makes a good life for being a human, whether you've offended or not. And I always thought it was very good. And so it allows you a chance to kind of go through and think about, well, what do I need in terms of autonomy? What do I need in terms of relationships? What do I need? And it gives people a really lovely framework to just kind of work through and think about, what do I have in this area? What do I need in this area that I don't currently have? And how can I start shifting things in the right direction?
Yeah, I think people will find that really helpful, because sometimes having something practical like that to sit down and do and to work through, particularly if you are somebody who does journaling, some of those things are really helpful as prompts to kind of explore things a little bit more. It was interesting. I was talking to my sister the other day about meditation, and we were saying about, she said, oh, I really want to get into doing just a few minutes a day of meditation. She was saying, and I can understand completely, that sometimes the thought of doing it is nerve-wracking, because she said to me, oh, do you do any? And I said, yeah, I do. I said, I really, again, like with the journaling, I've really tried to make time for sitting in solitude, and, you know, obviously working on certain podcasts will help me with certain things that I hear a lot around what's important, and solitude is one that comes up time and time again. But for her, she said, I worry about what's going to come up when I'm sitting there, like, am I going to suddenly feel a certain way about myself, or certain things that perhaps we're really good distracting ourselves, aren't we, with kind of processing emotions. And she just said, I've downloaded the Calm app, I've got it ready to go. And she said, but I just cannot do it, because there's that fear that when I do sit down, that some of the things that perhaps I haven't wanted to be thinking about will come to the surface. And I suppose, do you think that's something that's quite a common thing, that maybe people like are listening to this and they're thinking, oh, you know, I'd like to do that exercise that you were talking about. What do I need? What am I not getting? But actually it can bring up stuff that perhaps they don't feel they're ready to deal with.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think avoiding our emotions and avoiding, you know, what we think may come up or what we believe may come up is a common thing. And again, there's a bit of an anecdote in the book about that with a client of mine who, when we had gone through the sort of assessment and the formulation of the difficulty, they were angry. And they were angry because they felt that could no longer be kind of boxed back up. It was out. And when it was out, and when it had been spoken about and shared in a particular way, it completely debunked the way that they'd been thinking about things before. And at that point, I just felt hard and difficult and challenging. And, you know, I say this to people, you need to be ready for therapy. You need to have the toolkit in place that if you become distressed or things are difficult, that you have that all in place before you jump on in. Because, you know, my book is obviously not therapy, but it, you know, if you do the exercises within it, things can come up, and things can come up in meditation. But there's only one route, and it's through.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's just the mic drop there. I love that. Yeah, you're absolutely right. Yeah, we're all going on a bear hunt. We can't go over it, or wherever the bear hunt is, we have to go through it. So yeah, absolutely. What a great thing to just reflect on, because we can so often look, can't we, for the path of least resistance or different ways that perhaps we can avoid that avoidance technique. And yeah, I guess for you, you must see and have opinions, I suppose, on how we might use technology to numb ourselves and our emotions. So, yeah, I mean, I just think it's so important to find a way somehow of sitting with our emotions. And perhaps I was doing the show notes actually for a podcast, and it was with a Norwegian explorer, and he was talking about this whole idea of silence and solitude. And, you know, he was saying that, you know, it's just about being sort of, you know, just, I guess, sort of sitting with it. And you know, he was talking about that when nowadays we're not actually able to be bored. Like we're so quick to find something to relieve our boredom. Thanks. But I feel like it could be the same, I guess, for processing our emotions, whereas before perhaps there wasn't the distractions that we have now, so we were sort of I don't know, maybe forced more to confront them, but then perhaps got better at, I'm thinking of my parents' generation of the stiff upper lip and the kind of resilient, you know, I think of resilience is just not deal with their emotions. But it's funny, isn't it, that I suppose now it's almost like a different thing, I suppose, maybe for you in your practice, to kind of, for people to be able to just try and process them and to know that it's going to be uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, sometimes people come to therapy, they start the assessment process and they step away because it's too much. And yeah, I mean, again, the social media debate that's raging at the moment is, you know, very topical, and it's difficult to know. But I think we are definitely in the middle of a mental health crisis in the UK. We are struggling to meet the demand. And I don't think that it's coincidental that this increase has come at a time in our history when we are not able to sit without, you know, a phone. And the other part of it is that the attentional part of it in particular really worries me. So the short form content that our children and that we are engaging in, I think just typically makes your brain look for that quick fix dopamine hit. And then when you're then writing a book and you have to sit for periods of time, and actually just do the one thing without being distracted by your phone or by something else, it can be very hard. And I think that's because our brains have wired up for this over here. And then you're trying to do this more long form flow state thing. And I think I can see that in my children sometimes, that they struggle with that. And I think as parents, I could go on about this for a long time, Steph, but I think as parents, we do have to think about that and be balanced about, you know, that too.
Yes. And I think that could be a whole separate conversation around, children, because I think you're absolutely right. And, you know, just kind of before we move on to your book process, I was just went to a GCSE evening for my youngest the other day. And this was one of the things that they really brought up in the parent information session, was this whole idea of children think they can multitask by having something going on that's perhaps like videos playing or and trying to revise. They were also saying, you know, about this research that's come out around how long it takes us to be able to refocus after being distracted. And it's like 23 minutes. And that if, you know, about this whole idea of being able to sustain an amount of focus on, in their case, revision. And they were saying even if they have to put their phone outside for 30 minutes and just try and do 30 minutes of uninterrupted stuff. And I just thought, it is hard. It is hard because, you know, like you, you know, when I'm writing, sometimes I have to turn notifications off. I have to just have absolutely nothing, because I will, as soon as you hear it or the vibration happens or whatever, you're there, aren't you? And I think it's, and we're adults and we can struggle with that. So they're younger, you know, they're not fully developed brains yet, are going to also, I mean, that must just be, and my son is an absolute, you know, nightmare with it. Sometimes he'll say, I'm just listening to some music or I'm just listening to a podcast and I'm trying to revise. And you cannot do the two things. You cannot do the revision well if you've got something. And he's claims, you know, bless him, that yes, he can do that. But yeah, it's just, it is fascinating. But as I say, I mean, maybe in the future you come back on and we can have a little chat about that. I'd find that fascinating. But I think, you know, just thinking about that and you know, kind of segueing nicely into your writing process around distraction and being able to write. How was the process for you? How did you find, you know, deciding, right, I'm going to do this. This is something I am absolutely now committed to doing, which I think is a decision. And once you've made it, you're then kind of in it and you have to do it. How did you find the process? Did you enjoy writing or did you find it sort of a kind of roller coaster?
Yeah, I think a bit up and down really. And there were days I really enjoyed it and days where it was really hard. And I guess there was two parts to that. The first part being where I had the sort of 6 months to write the book proposal and, you know, was kind of sat in that place of feeling like an imposter. I'd been at this big event where there were people clutching their already physical books in their hands, trying to pitch it to people, you know. And I was just like, I'm never going to cut through this noise. I just kept this. I'm never going to cut through this noise. It won't be meaningful enough. It won't be. And then it was about a month and a half out, and I finally was like, it doesn't matter, because even if I don't win this competition, I will write this book and I will find a way of doing it. And I did make a very conscious decision then, and I made my practice then quite intentional. And I say intentional as it can be when you've got five kids and a Labrador and another job. So my writing practice tended to be lots of stolen moments here and there. And once I'd won and I realised, like, I'm contracted now and I'm duty bound to have something, that then became something different, which in many ways was helpful, but also quite scary.
Yeah.
And then what that then became was me really understanding, when did I write best? How did I write best? And that for me was literally, and when could I get into that sort of flow state? And for me, that was getting up at 4:45 in the morning and writing from 5 till 6 and then starting the day. Mm. And so I was exhausted.
Yeah, I bet you were. Yeah.
I was exhausted. And I didn't do it every single day. I couldn't have done that. I just tried to sort of wax and wane with, if I needed more sleep, I couldn't do that morning. Or and just in that way, the book came out of that process. And I think now, so I'm already, I have an idea for a second book. I have no contract or don't know what I'm doing about that. But I feel like in a way, there's a freedom to that, like, because I don't have a contract. If I was to just start writing now, I think that would feel freer and not quite as arduous.
Yeah, I can imagine. And listen, I feel your pain, because I wrote my first 2 or 3, I think, in that 5 to 6 a.m. slot. And it is a lot. And it's definitely something that you have to be fueled by something deep within you to want to get up to do that. So hats off to you, because it is painful. And I do think it's interesting, isn't it, that there's that almost that it goes from being something that you think, oh, how can I fit it in? And then, like you said, with the kind of with the contract and knowing that there was an expectation from an editor for you to, you know, give your manuscript in on a certain date, there is something, isn't there, that kind of fuels you. Then you're like, no, this shit's getting real now. I've got to just find a time. And so, yeah, I think it's really helpful. And it's harder, I think, when you self-publish to be able to have that fire if there's nobody chasing you. And that's why I always try and say to people early on, you know, if you've got an editor, try and get a date in with them, because then you are working towards something. Otherwise, it's a very open-ended. How did you feel? Because I know you talk, you know, in the book about perfectionism. How did you feel in terms of trying to battle that when it came to writing, particularly like your first draft and like allowing it to be messy and a bit horrible, because they always are?
Yeah, I'm not going to lie. I didn't do well with that, Steph, because I am a perennial editor. So I do exactly the thing that you're not supposed to do. So I write and go back and write and go back. But equally, what that then created in the end was a finished product that didn't require lots and lots of editing at the end. And it's not that it wasn't edited, it was, and that was really useful and supportive and adjuncted in ways that I wouldn't have known to do certain things. But there were moments where I was like, this is just rubbish. This, you know, it just, just that self-doubt, and having to just work with that. And there were days where I just had to get up and say, I can't do it today. I'm not doing it today, because it's unhelpful. Even once it had gone to the publisher, I hadn't really anticipated this, but the fear around publication day, and finally realizing, oh my God, someone will now read this. And what if Lucy, my editor, who was amazing and lovely and such a lovely person, has just been sugarcoating this whole time, and is actually not going to land the way that I hope it will land? And it's out there then. I can't take it back. It's done now. So I think it was just a case of giving myself the grace and the space to have those days, and to know that, again, it's very sort of, but like, that was my psychology pushing through and trying to keep me safe and trying to keep me in comfort as opposed to out of comfort.
Yeah.
I think that's something for listeners, if they're, you know, looking to write a book, you have to know that it's going to be hard and difficult, and you're going to feel like it's not worth anything at some point or another. Mm-hmm. And you have to be the person that overrides that.
And, yeah, but like therapy, you've just got to go through.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, I definitely learned a lot about myself from writing the book, definitely. Not the content of the book, because that helped in its own way, but just the actual process of what it's like to sit down every morning, continuously write a book, send it to someone, hope for the best, keep going, It definitely takes commitment and dedication.
It does. But I also think I find that whenever I'm in those moments where I'm like, oh, I just cannot even be bothered to look at this anymore, because there's a point where you just get sick of your own words and your own theories about things. You're just like, oh my goodness, I can't look at it anymore. And it's a weird thing about having to just have to, like you said, you just still have to sit your bum in the chair. You still just have to like, I'm just going to keep going. And there are days where you're like, I'm just going to do just what I need to do today. Or, and I think it was really great that you said this. And I feel like that definitely with the book that is currently being edited, is that I was much more compassionate this time round than I probably have been with my other books, which is, do you know what, I am not feeling this today. And noticing that and thinking, do you know what, it's okay. I'll know I'll sit down tomorrow, because this means, what it means to me, you know, is important enough for me to carry on. But just today, it's not happening. And so it took me longer than I anticipated, but I'm actually happier at the back end of it with what it sounds like, but also with my kind of feelings about the experience. It's fun, isn't it?
Yeah, and actually one of the things that I did do as I would get up at 4:45 and I would meditate. And I had this one meditation that I used every single morning. And then I would sit down after that. I would, you know, it became like a bit ritualistic and a bit sort of like a practice. I would have some incense and I had a playlist of music. So in a way, multitasking. However, it was like instrumental. Yeah. Like I couldn't listen to words. It was like instrumental music. And that became like the sound that went on in the background. And it was just all the cues that helped me sort of build the ritual over time.
So delighted you said that, Laura, because I've just written a whole chapter in my book about rituals and the art of a writing practice. And that is exactly the kind of stuff I was saying. And I'm absolutely the same as you. I can listen to music, but it has to be classical. It has to be no lyrics. Otherwise, I find myself singing along. And then I can't think of the word because I'm too busy singing. So I think it's so great to hear that you developed a practice, because like I say in the book, everyone's practice will be different, but actually it has to be the right practice for you. And it has to be full of the things that help you to get the work done, because sometimes it's those little things that you cling to in those times of challenge when you're thinking, I can't write anymore, or this isn't working, or why am I bothering, and all that self-sabotage stuff that comes up. But I think just having those little things, for me, it's always like I always make that my really favorite coffee, because then I think, oh, I'm going to have a coffee. It's just little things that, even though they seem insignificant when you talk about them months later, they were like the things that you could just cling on to, because you're like, actually, I'm going to have a nice coffee. I'm going to put this playlist on. My brain knows when it hears this particular playlist, that means I'm writing, and all that sort of stuff. So I'm delighted to hear that you had a little ritual as well, because I think it's more powerful than people probably anticipate when they haven't got one.
Just hearing you speak about it, I mean, what you're really doing is creating pleasure.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, you're creating pleasure to something that can feel not nice.
Yeah.
Sometimes. So that nice coffee or the smell of incense or the stillness of the morning, you know, whatever. And I think whatever works for you, do that.
Absolutely. In terms of, we're sort of wrapping up in the next few minutes, but I would just love to know, because a lot of my audience, as I say, are self-publishers, and I've had a few people on who've had publishing contracts. And I think it's really interesting for people to hear, like, what is that like to sign? And it's particularly with Hay House, who are so well known in this space around personal development and looking after the self. And I just think I'd love it if you could just share a little bit about, you know, how that journey was, you know, the kind of, what do you feel were the best parts of working with a publisher? Because like I said, for a lot of people, that's not the avenue they go down. So I think it'd be really interesting.
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously I'm still in it now because I'm in the marketing phase of everything and the promotional phase. But I mean, I think I had always wanted, like, if someone had asked me 10 years ago, who do you want to publish with? I would have said Hay House. So it felt very much like winning the lottery to me, this idea of, oh my God, I'm publishing with this publisher that I've held in such high esteem. My experience of that has lived up to it. And I feel very, very lucky to have landed with a publisher who believe and are aligned with my values in terms of how we nurture people, how we, you know, support people, you know, who are trying to become authors. And I think that is likely to be quite different in other publishing houses, just because of the very nature of what Hay House does. Mm-hmm. Now, I can't talk to that with any degree of intelligence, because I obviously haven't published, but I'm now understanding more about how the publishing industry works. And it does feel like it might be a bit more cutthroat out there in the wilderness than what I have received. So my experience has been very nurturing. I was assigned a team. Everything was very clear about who was doing what and when. My editor was just absolutely wonderful and never, ever made me feel under pressure. And that has been an absolute, you know, pivotal part of my journey, I think, in doing this. And I'm so glad.
Yeah, it's so great to hear, because I know that last week I saw the bookseller put something out about statistics around author well-being, particularly people who are traditionally published, and how publishing houses are having to step up now and really look after their authors, particularly those authors who are debuts or who are mid-list authors who perhaps aren't going to get the marketing budget of, you know, your big names that are like in that 1% who get a lot of the attention and the time. And I think it's desperately needed. And I've had, you know, in my kind of capacity as a book coach, I sometimes have people who come to me and they have traditional deals and they're not getting that support. And they're coming to me because they're like, I don't know whether what I'm doing is right, or I don't know whether, you know, nobody's really telling me what I'm supposed to be doing and I'm really lost. And I feel like it's just such a varying kind of degrees of experience people are having. And it's so nice to hear that your experience with Hay has been so nurturing and supportive, and you feel like it's been a good experience, because there have been people that I've spoken to, not on the podcast, but just who just had the polar opposite of an experience. And so it's really heartening to hear that there are still publishing houses out there that are getting it right and are supporting their authors.
Yes, and I think, I mean, if anybody does know Hay House, they'll know that there are authors who have been with them for years and years and years, and they just, you know, keep publishing with Hay House. They've never moved, they've never thought to move. And I think that tells its own story. Yeah. And someone at an event I was at recently who's part of the team said to me, oh, no, once you're a Hay House author, you're always a Hay House author.
Amazing.
And we will all, and it's just such a nice feeling to, you know, to know that they've got your back type thing. And that said, it's also a challenge as a debut author who has a modest platform to try and give it traction, just as you say, because obviously there's the one percenters who are up there and who they just have to write the book and people will buy it. And it's not been that way for me because, you know, my platform is small. And so it's a lot of work.
Yeah. But it's good to hear, though, that you've had that opportunity of a publishing deal and that you haven't got the enormous platform, because I think sometimes people are, and rightly so, they assume that they wouldn't get a publishing deal because they haven't got hundreds and thousands of followers, or they haven't got an enormous podcast or whatever it might be. And I think it's reassuring, I guess, for people to hear also that that isn't the case. That, you know, I mean, I've done, you know, for kind of podcast guests before on Feel Better, Live More, I remember we used to have sometimes authors on there who were absolutely experts in their field, but they didn't have social media platform at all. So when it was just like, and I used to think, actually, that's quite good, because it makes you realize that if you're good at what you do and you've got a story to tell and you can tell it well and you've got something that's helpful, you know, if you can cut through a lot of the kind of the noise around it, that they are still looking for great books. It's not always about, you know, oh, they've got, you know, a million followers, therefore they can just, it doesn't matter really. We'll give them a publishing deal, whatever. There are still publishers out there that are looking for great content.
Yeah, they're looking for the great content. And then at the back of that, you know, in order to get that content moving, you do need to have something. And so that's kind of where I'm at the moment, trying to promote, trying to speak about my book wherever I can. And I suppose it is worth people thinking about, you know, even though you can get book deals that way, it would be worth you starting to look at your social media presence, because that is unfortunately the way things are going, and it's not how it used to be. So yeah,
and it's so important, I think, when you do a book proposal, that you're able to say the ways in which you're going to be able to promote it, because that's what publishers want to know. They want to know how are you going to market it, because they haven't got the budget to put masses behind every author, so they have to rely on the author to promote it and do the work. I just love it, before we finish, I also think it's inspiring for people to hear, like, what opportunities have come off the back of you publishing your book. Have you done anything particularly exciting, or anything that you never thought you were going to do and has come around?
What has happened so far? So, I mean, I guess opportunities are coming to me now in a way that they never did, whereas I was sort of chasing those opportunities. So, you know, for example, podcast interviews, I'm just starting to get into that now a bit more because we've done that initial sort of couple of months of pushing it just in social media. So one of the most exciting things was Hay House invited me to a mastermind event in London. And I hadn't really understood what it was until I got there and fully sort of it landed with me that there were only 30 sort of people in this room that were authors. And I had been one of the ones who were invited. And I think it was just that moment of sort of looking at people like Vex King, you know, Kyle Gray, who's recently had a Sunday Times bestseller, Dr. David Hamilton, who's a fellow Scot, and these people who I'd only ever seen on a screen, and I'm in a room with them as some sort of equal, and just like, how have I got here?
Amazing.
Yeah, and that's been just such a lovely part of this. And also, what was the best bit about that, though, was realising that they're just human, like yes. You and I. And that, you know, they were there, they were asking questions, they were still thinking about their promotion. And it was just so validating to hear they don't have it all together behind closed doors. They're all still learning mm-hmm. and trying to do certain things. And I think that's been a hugely important thing for me to see. And then there's been opportunities to write for the press. So I'm looking at writing some articles and things for some newspapers. And off the back of that, we're looking at some TV opportunities. Whether that comes or not, we'll see. That kind of scares me slightly, but we're getting there.
Brilliant. I mean, I love that. And I love to hear, I feel so strongly that we should have more women on these kind of panels and, you know, being able to talk about their expertise and being in these rooms that perhaps, yes. you know, that we haven't always been, you know, able to step into. So I'm thrilled that it's doing so well. And I've loved every minute of watching this journey unfold, because obviously, like you said, before the Hay House contract, we were just chatting and we were like, yeah. you know, and then it all happened. And I just couldn't be more delighted, because I think what you do is brilliant. And I've loved watching it all unfold as a spectator, to be like, oh gosh, what's happened? So, you know, so many congratulations. And I really appreciate you coming on to the podcast and sharing more about what the book is about, but also your journey, because I think people find it super, super inspiring. And also you got a Mel Robbins endorsement. So listen, you're right up there in my jealousy, which is probably something if there's some therapy there that I need to kind of get over. But in terms of, yeah, just seeing her endorse your book on the cover and you know, on Amazon was just, yeah, loved it. So congratulations for having a Mel endorsement.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. I don't know if we have time for it, but that was an interesting story, because that wasn't, that wasn't arranged through the publishing at all. That was just a moment where Mel had talked on our socials about therapy. I'd responded. She or one of our team responded. And I just had this moment of thinking, what if I could just email Mel Robbins? Because I'd half joked with my publisher about, oh, you know, Mel Robbins would be great as an endorsement. And we all laughed and moved on. But this day, I just took it upon myself, emailed her team and said, would she be willing? And they came back inside of an hour and a half and said, she normally doesn't have the bandwidth or the time, but send your manuscript and we will see what we can do. And I'm like jumping up and down, and I could tell my publisher were still like, not sure, because obviously they've tried with other big authors to get, mm-hmm. and they hadn't made it. And then sure enough, this one day, and it drops into my inbox and I was absolutely blown away. So I think I like telling that story, because I think it's just a moment of backing yourself and just, you know, knowing that you might be rejected and that would be okay. But sometimes really good things come off the back of putting yourself out there.
And if you don't ask, you don't get, right? So it's always worth asking. Is she a Hay House author? I think she is, isn't she?
She's a Hay House author. So I think that was partially why she opted to do it. And
I bet.
It feels very special as part of my first book. So,
I can't wait to hear about book two. And like I said, so many congratulations on the brilliant stuff.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming on.
Thank you, Steph, for having me.
You're very welcome. Thank you for listening to this conversation with Laura. I hope it's given you plenty to reflect on, whether you're navigating your own healing, thinking about your writing practice, or simply needing a reminder that you are not alone in how you feel. You can find links to Laura's book and her social media in the show notes. And if you enjoyed this episode, I'd love it if you subscribed, left a review, or shared it with someone who might find it helpful. But until next time, happy writing.